Fire service roles in different countries, they account for less than 20% of firefighters worldwide.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Environmental groups filed a complaint with the Federal Trade Commission, FTC, saying that oil giant Chevron's ad campaigns and consumer reports mislead the public about the company's environmental impact. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Sharon Zhang Ryder. This article is published under the heading First of its Kind Complaint Filed Against Chevron for Greenwashing Campaigns. Stay tuned for more. Environmental groups recently filed a complaint with the Federal Trade Commission, FTC, saying that oil giant Chevron's ad campaigns and consumer reports mislead the public about the company's environmental impact. The group say that the complaint is the first of its kind. Earthworks, Greenpeace USA, and Global Witness, the groups behind the complaint, say that the company has violated the FTC's green guides. We are asking the FTC to issue an enforcement that would deter Chevron and other oil and gas companies from continuing their misinformation campaigns in the future. Josh Eisenfeld, who campaigns for corporate accountability for Earthworks, told reporters. Chevron, Eisenfeld points out, has emitted the second most emissions of any fossil fuel company since 1965. The group's Eisenfeld says hope that the FTC will order Chevron to remove their misleading marketing claims and issue corrective statements. They also hope the FTC will bar future such statements from the company. The FTC's green guides were established in the 1990s and were aimed at ensuring that companies do not mislead customers about how environmentally friendly their products are. In other words, greenwashing. Chevron, the group say, has participated in this greenwashing in their advertising campaigns and in a recent report touting its climate initiatives. The 56-page climate change resilience report that Chevron released recently opens with a Chevron executive's claim that the company is committed to helping achieve a lower carbon future. But the environmental groups point out the report makes no new commitments to reduce the company's greenhouse gas emissions on top of their already flimsy commitments. Meanwhile, Chevron announced plans to increase its total oil and gas production with new drilling sites in the Permian Basin and assured the oil and gas industry that they are committed to maintaining their grip on the fossil fuel industry. Chevron is trying to appeal to consumers that care about the climate, the planet, and racial justice. while doubling down on climate-wrecking fossil fuels that pollute communities and destabilize the global climate, said Julieta Boehner, U.S. Communications and Campaign Officer at Global Witness, in a statement. We urge the FTC to take swift action and show big polluters they cannot get away with greenwashing. The green groups also condemned Chevron's ad campaigns on social media and TV. These ads mislead consumers with deceptive jargon such as reducing emissions intensity while continuing to increase overall oil and gas extraction and production, they write. Chevron's oil and gas advertisements have come under scrutiny over the past years as it becomes increasingly clear and widely known that the fossil fuel industry has been perpetuating a decades-long disinformation campaign about whether global warming and the climate crisis are caused by the burning of fossil fuels. Ads by companies like Exxon, Chevron, and BP have been criticized for parading their climate commitments in the form of investments in renewable energy, while independent reports have found that these investments are actually only a small fraction of their yearly expenditures. Chevron, for example, spends less than 0.2% of its capital expenditures on renewable energy, the groups point out. The world's second biggest polluter shouldn't advertise that they are good for the environment. Our field work shows Chevron is regularly polluting methane, a greenhouse gas 86 times more potent than carbon dioxide, said Eisenfleld in a statement, adding Chevron's plan to convince the public and investors that they are fixing this problem when they're not is dishonest and very dangerous. These sorts of ads are an extension of the fossil fuel industry's attempts to spread climate denial, the environmental groups say. Chevron spent decades sowing doubt about the science of climate change, said Anusha Nairan, Greenpeace climate campaign manager. For the oil and gas industry, delay and distraction are the new denial. Advertising has long been a part of the fossil fuel industry's strategies to perpetuate climate denial, studies have found. The amount of money big oil companies spend on advertising directly relates to how much Congress is talking about climate change legislation. Robert Brule, a Drexel University environmental sociologist, told Heated in 2019. If Congress is silent and there is no worry about the climate legislation, their spending on corporate promotion goes way down.
We get people.
GOP Civil War.
Donald Trump has embarked on a journey of revenge to round up those disloyal to him. He returned to his party not long after some Republicans turned against him over incitement of violence at the U.S. Capitol.
Please welcome the 45th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump.
Do you miss me yet? Do you miss me? I'm going to continue to fight right by your side. We will do what we've done right from the beginning, which is to win.
Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi. In this episode, we will delve into the infighting within the GOP, which still continues, although the former president has asserted that he's not after founding his own party. Among those flipping were seven Republicans who voted to convict him in his second impeachment trial at the Senate. There are still Republicans who speak out against him, perhaps fearing that he may be stealing the party, though many believe that Republican Party is already a Trump party. So what's going on inside the GOP? Let's see.
Speaking of bombing the Middle East, have you seen Liz Cheney's poll numbers? Now, listen, the one thing I'll say for Liz Cheney is I'm sure she has a lot of bipartisan support, because if there's one thing that she and Joe Biden definitely want to do, it's bomb the Middle East.
Trump has not lost his popularity among the majority of conservatives, a point he probably had in mind when he appeared at the CPAC. He sounded like a de facto GOP nominee, confident in repeating his old stances as about another Trump rally. While he asserted that he was not seeking to found his own party, the former president tried to indicate that he is still the one at helm in the so-called Grand Old Party. So should Republicans opposing him quit?
Have I been frustrated? Yes. Sure, have I had moments where I thought, I can't believe what I'm seeing, what the heck is going on? Who are these people? You know, they're not my Republicans, which makes it even more important that those of us who are law-abiding citizens and do not believe in the kind of chaos that took place, make sure that our party finds its way again and finds the center of where we belong. And I believe there's enough people out there that are going to do just that.
A gilded statue of Trump brought to the CPAC event in Orlando, Florida, said a thing or two about the nation's biggest annual gathering of grassroots conservatives and how it views the former president. We're now joined by Wilmer Leon. Mr. Leon, is the GOP actually a Trump party with a minority of anti-Trump Republicans?
I think the Republican Party is divided. There's a debate on the size of the divide, but I do believe that right now Donald Trump is in control of the party. And some would argue that they're really fighting more over style than substance. But I think with the heightened racism that has been on display through as a result of what we saw with the insurrection on January 6th, that this is causing a real substantive problem for the party.
Many thanks for your insight, Mr. Leon.
Some establishment Republicans opposing Trump are pursuing their own interests rather than bowing to him. One example of Trump's lack of control on the party is the case of Wyoming Senator Liz Cheney, who also voted in favor of Trump's conviction. At the CPAC, Trump called Dick Cheney's daughter a warmonger who loves seeing our troops fighting.
The good news is in her state, she's been censured, and in her state, her poll numbers have dropped faster than any human being I've ever seen. So hopefully they'll get rid of her with the next election. Get rid of them all.
Another example is some GOP support for the Alaska senator's re-election bid in 2022, despite her vote for conviction of Trump in the Senate impeachment trial.
This is while Trump has clearly said that the party needs to dismiss Senator Lisa Murkowski. As members of the same party attack each other like that, the depth of the GOP civil war is unveiled. Bob Ayers is with us for more on this. Mr. Ayers, first of all, a direct question to clear one issue. Do you expect a Trump challenger to rise in the party before 2024 to lessen his chance of GOP nomination?
Well, if Trump is not convicted as a result of any of the ongoing investigations, there probably would not be a challenger arise. But if Trump is convicted and consequently barred from holding office again, there will be a scurry of many different Republican contenders trying to succeed to the presidency. So whether or not there's going to be a challenger depends on whether or not Trump is in jail at election time.
Trump has clearly created a chasm in the GOP. alienating a portion of the Republican Party that turned against him. His quick return to the political scene, in part, laid bare his hunger for revenge and for remaining the party's alpha male with an unwavering support.
We're not starting new parties. You know, they kept saying, he's going to start a brand new party. We have the Republican Party. It's going to unite and be stronger than ever before. I am not starting a new party. Many people have asked, what is Trumpism? A new term being used more and more. I'm hearing that term more and more. I didn't come up with it. It means low taxes and eliminating job-killing regulations, Trumpism. It means strong borders. It means no riots in the streets.
I don't know how.
The fact that a rather not worthy percentage of Republicans no longer support Trump could change the dynamics of power in the party for years to come, even though the former president is mostly focused on partnership than conservative policies and ideas.
The uncertainty in GOP could fan the flames of violence and extremism already gripping the party. Mr. Ayers, what do you think about the situation Republican politicians are in right now?
Politicians have an ability to adapt their policy to whatever the needs of the moment are. They're not policy-driven, they're events-driven. And you'll see the policies change as the events around them change. If Trump is convicted in a federal court and barred from holding office, all of the Trump supporters will suddenly become non-Trump supporters.
If the billionaire businessman fails to somehow make peace with the leaders of his own party, the GOP effort to win back majority at the U.S. House in 2022 midterms could go to waste. No matter how small, the anti-Trump minority could potentially stop him from getting elected in the next presidential election. Despite that, duplicity in the GOP runs so deep.
There's no question. None. That President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of the day. No question about it. The people who stormed this building believed they were acting on the wishes and instructions of their president. And having that belief was a foreseeable consequence of the growing crescendo of false statements, conspiracy theories, and reckless hyperbole.
Mitch McConnell, the top Republican in the Senate, is a paragon of double policies. He initially opposed Trump's incitement of an insurrection at the Capitol. He even backed a second impeachment effort by Democrats, but ultimately voted to acquit the former president. A Kentucky Senator, McConnell, now says he will even support Trump's GOP nomination for the 2024 presidential election. How do you think figures like Senator McConnell can justify their double policies?
It's one thing if Mitch McConnell or Lindsey Graham were trying to appeal to a much broader element of the electorate. But I think you have to understand that these are very transactional people, that they don't have a solid ideology. They don't have a well thought out worldview. They are very transactional. They operate issue by issue, and that enables them to change positions on a whim.
As Trump strengthens his grip on the Republican caucus, those turning against him are forced to reconsider their position. After Trump called on his supporters to storm the Capitol in an attempt to disrupt the counting of the Electoral College votes, many in the GOP thought the measure amounted to the last nail in the coffin of his political career.
Those who choose to continue to support is a dangerous gambit by objecting to the results of a legitimate Democratic election will forever be seen as being complicit in an unprecedented attack against our democracy. Fairly or not, they'll be remembered for their role in this shameful episode in American history. That will be their legacy.
Now that Trump has come back with relatively full support from the Republican voters, those politicians are afraid of losing their power. Some are flipping again, and some sticking to their own agenda. Either way, the GOP seems to be facing a rocky road to the 2022 and the 2024 races. The Democratic efforts to cancel Trump have failed despite two impeachment trials. What plans do Democrats have to ensure Trump cannot hold public office by 2024?
Well, that's interesting because there's an assumption in your question that the Democratic Party is some sort of homogeneous, monolithic whole, and the Democratic Party is just as fragmented as the Republicans are, albeit for different reasons. You have very strong liberals and very strong conservatives all within the Democratic Party. And until the Democratic Party can stop fighting amongst themselves, they're not going to be able to take advantage of weaknesses in the Republican Party.
Now let's see what Danny has for us this week. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Milad. Today I will place a lens on the anti-Trump faction of the Republican Party, its motivations, and its prospects for political success in future election cycles. The anti-Trump faction of the Republican Party is quite clearly an expression of establishment politics in the United States. During the 2020 election cycle, more than 70 former national security officials in the CIA, FBI, and NSA threw their support for Joe Biden and the Democratic Party. This included promoters and defenders of the U.S. invasion of Iraq and its War on Terror torture program, such as Colin Powell, John Negroponte, and Michael Hayden. Additionally, GOP super PAC The Lincoln Project led an alliance of holdovers of the George W. Bush era on a crusade to convince liberal America that it could depopularize Donald Trump in the Republican Party. $67 million later, and the Lincoln Project had failed miserably in its goal. Trump's one-term rule angered a small section of Republican national security elites who value consistency and predictability in its project to secure U.S. hegemony abroad. Never Trump Republicans, as they call themselves, have zero interest in growing inequality at home or endless U.S. military aggression abroad, but rather a return to an era when conservative corporate values were not associated with Donald Trump's personal and political antics. Still, Donald Trump remains immensely popular among the Republican Party's base, as his increased vote total in the 2020 election and his rousing speech at the Conservative Political Action Committee attest. It is unlikely that the business-as-usual politics of anti-Trump Republicans can compete with Trump's effective appeals to the economic and racial anxiety of the party's base, not least because they have yet to agree on a strategy. Expect Trump or Trump-like figures to dominate the Republican Party in future election cycles.
After his embarrassing defeat and refusal to accept the presidential outcome, Trump showed up at the Conservative Political Action Conference and called them out by name, telling the audience, "Get rid of them all."
The Democrats don't have grandstanders like Mitt Romney, Little Ben Sasse, Richard Burr, Bill Cassidy, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Pat Toomey. And in the House, Tom Rice, South Carolina, Adam Kinzinger, Dan Newhouse, Anthony Gonzalez, that's another beauty, Fred Upton, Jamie Herrera Butler, Peter Meyer, John Katko, David Valadao, and of course the warmonger, a person that loves seeing our troops fighting, Liz Cheney. How about that?
Trump's attacks on the incumbents is shedding light on the sharp difference with the establishment wing of the party. On his agenda, there seems to be a rather long list of Republicans flipping against him, including the 10 Republican House representatives who voted in favor of their party leader's impeachment. The House Republican leader, like many others in the GOP, is stuck between a rock and a hard place. The former president appears to be on track to revenge every single disloyal Republican. So are we going to have a Trump-only party?
Right now, it's still a Trump party, at least in philosophy. If Trump is successfully prosecuted in either state or federal court, it won't be a Trump party, but I think the very conservative philosophy that Trump ran on that got him elected will continue to remain a dominant theme within the Republican Party.
Ever since he ran for president, Trump has proven to the world that he is no ordinary politician. He defies decorum and improvises. He evades real issues by calling negative coverage of his performance fake news. And he is no fan of losing. Since the first days, Trump has been complaining about the rigged election system.
If you count the legal votes, I easily win. If you count the illegal votes, they can try to steal the election from us. If you count the votes.
Okay, here we are again in the unusual position of not only interrupting the President of the United States, but correcting the President of the United States. There are no illegal votes that we know of. There has been no Trump victory that we know of.
He has time and again claimed that if he loses an election, it means it was stolen. The President had no plan for a campaign failure, and when the official results showed that he had failed, he had to stick to his only solution, not accepting the outcome. Nothing has stopped him to this day, not even two impeachment trials. Mr. Leon, don't you think so?
When you talk about impeachment, let me say, I don't consider the impeachment trials and the failure to convict Donald Trump in the Senate, I don't really consider those efforts to be failures, because I believe that our Constitution demanded that Trump be impeached, and I believe that our Constitution demanded that the trial be held in the Senate. The fact that he was not convicted, well, the numbers weren't there. We knew, because of the partisan nature of our politics, we knew that the numbers weren't going to be in the favor of the Democrats.
The crack in the party is displaying the GOP's double policies and penchant for power on steroids. From Mitch McConnell to Mitt Romney and Lindsey Graham, the party is filled with faces who have changed their positions about Trump several times since he decided to run for the 2016 presidential election.
Friends, delegates, and fellow Americans, I humbly and gratefully accept your nomination for the presidency of the United States.
On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court dismissed Donald Trump's appeal of a ruling by a lower court upholding Wisconsin's handling of mail-in ballots. Joining me to discuss this news is Jim Kavanaugh. He's a political analyst and contributor to Counterpunch and ThePolemicist.net, where you can read his latest piece, The American Farce Unravels, Shreds of January 6th. Jim, what can you tell us about the significance of this decision? What might it mean for Trump and for those seeking to contest his relative dominance of the Republican Party and the political landscape more generally?
I don't think it means that much at all for Trump in the long run or in the medium run, whatever it is. You know, the election is not going to be overturned. The courts were not going to overturn it. But everyone should be aware that the actual integrity of the electoral process in the United States has been an issue for decades, since at least 2000. And, you know, this can never, it would never be decided after an election. The Democrats complained about the 2004 election, and rightfully so, and had a lot of issues with what happened in Ohio, which overturned the election. The Democrats, and they tried, Barbara Boxer came into the Senate and tried to stop the Electoral College vote. So this, and last year, in 2016, Hillary and Nancy Pelosi said the election had been stolen. We only lost by 80,000 votes. Trump only lost by 42,000 votes. So there's a whole set of issues with the American electoral process, from electronic voting machines to voter suppression and caging. The mail-in ballot process is what anybody wants to say. It's been for decades known to be bipartisan reports, three or four over the past 15 years, that it's the most susceptible to fraud. That the Republicans have used that process for their own benefit. Many times elections have been overturned from it. So there's a whole bunch of issues there that are not being covered and are just being dismissed, you know, by the idea that any complaint about an election is now undermining democracy, you know. So that's one thing. But, you know, going forward with Trump's influence on the Republican Party, you know, it's not just Trump. It's, you know, people like Josh Hawley and this woman, Marsha Green, you know, Republicans have actually increased their fundraising since January 6th. Even though their corporate fundraisers have backed out, they've gotten a lot of, you know, individual contributions. And there's going to be a tremendous backlash against the dismissal of any dissidents or any objection to elections or anything else. You really have the, as a result of January 6th, really the establishment, including the capitalist establishment for the most part, coalesced around the Democratic Party and dismissed Trump. And that was because, as opposed to Barack Obama, who came into power and said, I'm the one standing between you and the pitchforks, Trump, after 8 years of pretending to be a populist bull, actually broke some china and brought the pitchforks to the Capitol. And that's what you don't do. You can complain about elections, you can go into the Senate and try vote against the electoral vote process, but you can't bring 10,000 people into the street to storm the Capitol. That's against the rules. And, you know, it was for, you know, I don't think that most of those people were really worried about election integrity as much as they were election about the cult of personality around Trump. But now everything's going to be dismissed. Everybody who speaks of going out and fighting for what you believe in is going to be dismissed as a domestic terrorist. And people see through that, and there's going to be a backlash against that. And it may very well work in the favor of the Republicans. People, not Trump himself, who is clearly a member of the ruling class, but other Republican right-wing populists are going to come in and say, we're fighting the power. And it's going to, especially since the Democrats aren't doing anything to get the allegiance of the people. They put the $15 minimum wage in. If they put Medicare for all in, they would win every election. But they don't, and they won't.
It mustn't be a big surprise to see voters rejecting establishment politicians and sticking to Trump, even though he violated the rules of the United States' game. Unless he's silenced, Trump is expected to continue attacking the Biden administration and strengthen his bid for a second term. That was our show. Thank you for staying with us. I'm your host, Mila Javamadi. Please join us again next week on We the People.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
After having urged President Joe Biden to turn a temporary moratorium on new oil and gas leasing on federal lands and waters into a permanent ban on extracting climate-damaging fossil fuels from those areas, environmentalists criticize his administration's recent decision to not renew the Interior Department's policies limiting the provision of drilling permits. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kenny Stancil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Unfortunate, if not unexpected. Biden criticized for resuming public land drilling permits. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. After having urged President Joe Biden to turn a temporary moratorium on new oil and gas leasing on federal lands and waters into a permanent ban on extracting climate-damaging fossil fuels from those areas, environmentalists criticized harshly Biden administration's decision recently to not renew the Interior Department's policies limiting the provision of drilling permits. In a statement released recently, Food and Water Watch Policy Director Mitch Jones called the news unfortunate, if not unexpected. Biden ran on a promise of stopping fracking and fossil fuel extraction on public lands, said Jones. Thus far, his orders have failed to live up that promise. Environmental justice groups, including Food and Water Watch, applauded the president in late January for instituting a pause on new oil and gas permitting on federal lands and waters, during which administration officials would review the climate impacts of, as well as taxpayer compensation for, public lands drilling, as reporters said. A pause on drilling and fracking is good news, but only if it is followed by a strong plan to permanently ban all dirty energy extraction on public lands, Food and Water Watch Executive Director Venona Hatter said at the time. The simple truth, Hatter said earlier this year, is that we need to stop drilling and fracking everywhere as soon as possible. The federal government has the power and the moral responsibility to get off fossil fuels, and doing so on publicly owned land sends a positive message that the Biden administration is serious about confronting this issue head-on. In response to the Biden administration's recent decision to resume processing permits for oil and gas drilling, which coincided with the Senate's confirmation of Deb Haaland, a proponent of curbing fossil fuel extraction on federal lands and waters, as Interior Secretary, Jones said, temporary pauses are not enough at all. Limiting those pauses to leases is not enough, he continued. Bending to the political pressure of the fossil fuel industry is completely unacceptable. We call on Biden to keep his promise, a full and complete ban on fracking and fossil fuel extraction on public lands. Full stop, Jones said. The climate crisis requires it, and he promised it. According to reports, the Biden administration recently said U.S. Bureau of Land Management, BLM, office staff would resume processing oil and gas drilling permits later this week, following a two-month period when those approvals were limited to senior officials in Washington. In an emailed statement, the Interior Department said BLM officials would process applications for permits and related sun-dry activities on valid existing leases in a timely manner. The department, which oversees BLM, also said it would begin providing monthly updates on pending and approved drilling permits on federal lands in an effort to improve and improve transparency for the industry and the public. On his first day in office, the administration of Biden stripped Interior Department agencies and bureaus of their authority to issue drilling permits. The order, which expires on March 21st, appeared to be a first step toward delivering on Biden's campaign pledge to ban new leasing on federal acreage, though permits have continued to be processed in Washington. Later in January, the administration paused new oil and gas leases, triggering criticism from the oil industry and Republican lawmakers. The Interior Department will launch a formal review of the program on March 25th with a public forum. Federal mineral leasing was criticized heavily by environmentalists and Democrats during the administration of former President Donald Trump, who sought to maximize fossil fuel development on public lands.
The global war on Syria was and still is one of the few cases in history that highlights how several regional and Western regimes are involved in a conflict whose end is unknown. What do they want from Syria? Why this unending conflict? Syrians asked many questions, so did many people across the world who followed what happened in the country over the past 10 years. A decade later, Syria is still witnessing a bloody and brutal foreign intervention that ranges from sophisticated bombs to suffocating economic sanctions. The country has become a permissible arena for international conflict, in addition to internal and regional conflicts. Thus, the war, which began in the form of local acts of Wahhabi-funded terrorism, turned into a complex regional and international conflict that includes armies and militias. The same old U.S. interim national security strategy, whether it was Trump or Biden in office, is still in use. No matter the tools, the goals and strategies are the same, and its pillars, oil, Kurds, and the security of the Israeli regime, using crises the U.S. helped create as a method of conflict management. No U.S. withdrawals from the occupied region in the horizon. More like military repositioning and deployment, while emphasizing America's role in shaping, or rather creating, a new world order with a military focus in both the Pacific region and the Middle East. Developments on the ground confirm that the American strategy is no longer confined to economic pressure like the unjustified Caesar's Act. Rather, it goes beyond that towards reactivating the occupation and increasing warmongering rhetoric against Syria. The aim is to pressure it to accept the conditions of the so-called opposition, which in reality are U.S. demands already previously rejected by President Bashar al-Assad back in 2003, when former U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell brought them directly to Damascus immediately after the U.S. invaded Iraq. Biden now seeks to overcome the loopholes and confusion in dealing with the Syrian crisis during the Trump administration. Proof is how Daesh is back in action. Cutting the Syrian-Iraqi border is retained, and sanctions are to take a more tightening role as Israel continues its regular strikes, targeting any form of resistance against illegal foreign intervention in Syria. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. After a decade of unfathomable violence and human tragedy that has made Syria the West's defining war of the early 21st century, the fighting has tapered off, but the suffering hasn't. In 2011, Obama led the West in the largest adventure yet in West Asia, thinking that Syria looked like just another domino about to fall in the whirlwind of uprising sweeping the Middle East. 10 years later, President Bashar Assad is still there, leading the heroic Syrian Arab Army, which eliminated Western-backed Daesh terrorism from more than 70% of the country, as reconciliation and reconstruction define the upcoming decade for Syria. To discuss this issue with us from New York is a Syrian diplomat, Ms. Alia Al-Ali. Thank you for being with us, Alia. Now, during their open war on Syria, all throughout the past 10 years, the Americans continued to fabricate internal crises inside of Syria. They have occupied the eastern part of the Euphrates. They have plundered Syria's oil resources. They gave an open green light for Israel to bomb all sorts of facilities, hospitals, schools, you name it, inside of Syria, while suffocating the country with very harsh economic sanctions that could add up to collective punishment. How is it possible that the UN has not seen all of these violations yet?
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me. At first, I would like to say that for us Syrians, the passage of 10 years to the Syrian crisis does not call for celebrating the revolution as some are trying to portray the situation. Mm-hmm. It is with a heavy heart we remember this day as it marks 10 years of suffering for Syrian citizens after the United States, some Western and regional countries spent tens of billions of dollars in order to break up Syria and terminate its role in the region, especially in facing the policies of occupation and hegemony. So, back to your question, the Security Council has primary responsibility under the United Nations Charter for the maintenance of international peace and security. Unfortunately, some of the member states, permanent member states at the Security Council, namely the US, UK, and France, have failed miserably in meeting this duty. It is no secret that they supported and are still supporting terrorist groups such as ISIS, al-Nusra, HDS, etc. Mm-hmm. In all ways of support, be it funding, weapons, training, media, facilitating their infiltration into Syria, you name it. These very same countries are saving no efforts in prolonging this crisis in order to serve their own agendas at the expense of the lives of millions of innocent Syrians. On the other side, the situation, as gloomy and unbearable as is, would have been even worse if it wasn't for the support of the Russian Federation and China for Syria in this arena. Now, what our world needs today, and specifically under the umbrella of the United Nations, is constructive and courageous stances that distance the UN system from political and financial polarization. So when this happens, this distancing happens, the UN can find creative solutions for crises all over the world and make our world avoid the disastrous effects of creative chaos policies and attempts to change legitimate governments.
Well, Alia, in the past 10 years, the policy of both Barack Obama and Donald Trump has failed to achieve tangible results in Syria, and that policy of isolating Syria and suffocating it with sanctions has also failed to bring about any sort of change, especially to the approach of the Syrian government towards any sort of a political solution in Syria. Why is Biden then just playing the same old cards that his predecessors used against Syria?
Yeah, so like unable to achieve that regime change militarily, the Western governments imposed brutal illegal sanctions, causing death and suffering of millions of Syrians, depriving them of food, medicine, housing, education, and other vital rights. These illegal, immoral, inhuman unilateral coercive measures imposed against Syrians by the European Union, the United States, and other countries seriously amount to a crime against humanity. As a matter of fact, we all saw Trump go out, Biden come in. All that changes is the name over the door. So changing the administration apparently, or as it seems, doesn't mean changing the policies. Mm-hmm. Yet it is more important now than ever that those government should look realistically at the situation, the current situation, to see what their hostile policies have led to. Then they should, after they look at the situation, they should take measures to correct those wrong policies and adopt new approaches, constructive approaches based on respect for the principles of international law, which allows the restoration of peace and stability in Syria and the region.
Well, the current U.S. administration's admission of the failure of the military maneuvers, if you will, against Syria, they are not enough for them to maybe turn on the page of their aggression against the Syrian nation. Rather, it means that they might actually seek to overcome certain loopholes when dealing with the Syrian crisis that Trump had fallen into. What are Syria's options here in the event of a renewal in the violence against Syrian citizens and the Syrian Arab Army itself?
Yeah, you see, the resilience of Syrian people and their uniting behind their leadership have led to the failure of the destructive policies that were implemented during the last 10 years. So what the U.S. will not be able to achieve what it failed in during the last decade, because at the end of the day, the Syrian people will exert every effort to defend their independence, sovereignty, and unity, and territorial integrity. And that's our one and only option.
Well, one of the recurring U.S. strategies that you keep seeing in Syria is their unconditional support to the Kurdish separatist Contras in the northeastern part of Syria, especially in the governorates of Hasakeh and Qamishli, where we saw a lot of blockading, a lot of besiegement of the people, of the civilians in those two governorates, especially in Hasakeh, where last month we saw the murder. That's what it is. They murdered a Syrian security officer in Qamishli, and then they wounded a lot of people also with the shots that they fired at the angry public that wanted this besiegement to be broken. This resulted, as I said, in death and injuries. How will the Syrian government respond to such provocations if it is repeated, especially from the Kurdish Contras, which, by the way, are also Syrian citizens, who fall under the law of the Syrian constitution?
Well, there's an undeniable fact that the U.S. illegal presence on the Syrian territories is going to end sooner or later. Same applies for their proxies, as the separatist Kurdish militias or other proxies. In the recent incident you talked about, we saw the Syrian civilians in that area strongly protesting these practices of the U.S. and their proxies. Mm-hmm. So what we really believe in, that this deep sense of national belonging will safeguard the area from future provocations and eventually contributes to ending the occupation. You talked about like Kurdish or the militias are, at the end of the day, they're Syrian. Of course, when we talk about Syrian people respecting their this sense of belonging to their country, mm-hmm. We don't specify each ethnicity or each group belonging to a different background. There are bad people and good people, and there are very a lot of Kurdish Syrians who would save no effort in saving the unity and independence of Syria. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That is what we wish to see for the upcoming decade for Syria: prosperity, peace, and unity among all Syrians. Thank you very much for being with us, Ali Ali, a Syrian diplomat with us from New York. Thank you for being there very early in the day. Ali, it's an honor to have you on with us. Please stay tuned. Now, next, we will continue talking about what the upcoming U.S. Administration will have in its pockets for the Syrian crisis after the break.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
President Biden's foreign policy already seems stuck in the militarist quagmire of the past 20 years. It's a far cry from his campaign promises, by the way, to reinvigorate diplomacy as the primary tool of U.S. foreign policy. In this respect, Biden's approach on Syria shows he's just falling into the footsteps of former President Barack Obama and Donald Trump, who both promised fresh approaches to foreign policy, but for the most part delivered more endless wars. Now, Biden resumes Obama's war on Syria in this following report. Ten years, thousands of civilian deaths, nearly 10 million people forced from their homes, some displaced two or even three times since the war began, hundreds of hospitals and schools damaged or destroyed. The toll of a decade-long global war on Syria defies comprehension, a war that was triggered by Takfiri cults, which made way for blatant Western foreign intervention, has spiraled the debacle into one of the most devastating spectacles of brutal neocolonialism in the region of West Asia. The United States continues to impede the restoration of stability in the country through the imposition of economic sanctions. After its proxies lost most of its frontline advances, Washington is now using various methods of economic and political pressure on international bodies and organizations to turn a blind eye on the repercussions of such bans. A decade into the global war on the Levantine nation, the government in Damascus continues to make strenuous efforts to secure suitable and proper conditions for the return of Syrian refugees, reconstruct industrial and agricultural installations, create job opportunities despite the difficult economic situation in the country, all the while combating terrorism. Despite losing trust in what is known as the international community, Syrians who have suffered through the dreadful war and the continuous suffocating sanctions have yet to comprehend why no regional or international state dares to at least criticize the U.S. and its allies for their inhumane policies against Syria. Least they could do is call for embracing the international law and principles of the United Nations. However, it seems those laws and principles only apply on non-colonial states. The U.S. knows very well that the sanctions imposed on Syria target all Syrian people and obstruct the reconstruction process in the war-torn country. Biden knows that sanctions like the Caesars Act prevents the realization of a solution for humanitarian problems in Syria. This form of collective punishment, along with Biden's strikes on the Syrian border, is nothing short of a systematic terrorist campaign aimed at Syria's unity and territorial integrity. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Paris is Mr. Jean-Pierre Dutton, who is a political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Jean-Pierre. Now, on day one of his presidency, Biden revived Daesh terrorists inside Syria and reinforced their facilities in a Tel Aviv. He even flew them over from Hasakeh, from the prison, to attend base to allow them to start a new wave of attacks, both against the Syrian Arab army in that area, especially the route that gives way between Deir ez-Zor and Palmyra, and also against people, against the civilians, the Syrian civilians. What could come out of this old American ways? Any good of that?
I will tell you something, like I looked yesterday or maybe 3 days ago about what's happened with the European money. Don't talk about the American money. We spent millions of dollars, and American also, just to do one thing, to totally destroy a country and to make it go back, you know, to like the Middle Age for nothing. Like all these stories for nothing. No, it's not for nothing, to be totally exact. Mm-hmm. Because if you want to be clear,